Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Pioneer's Path on Atlanta Business Radio. I'm one of your co-hosts, Katie Galley, and I'm here with, of course, Tim O'Connor with the Terraform Group, and he's our host today. How are you doing, Tim?
I'm great, Katie. It is a pleasure to be here. We've got a couple of fantastic guests in the studio with us today.
Yeah. So who did you end up bringing with you?
Well, we have first up on our show, we have Mr. Cecil Phillips of Place Property. Cecil, how are you?
I'm doing great, Tim. How are you?
I am fantastic.
Good.
Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We had originally, it's a funny backstory, my mother-in-law is your next door neighbor. We didn't even realize it when you and I first connected.
The world's a smaller place than we think.
I know. So we have to watch what we say at all times is, I think, the rule of thumb.
That's good advice. Your mother probably told you that too.
She did. It didn't take till much later in life though. But well, good. Well, thanks again for being here, Cecil. So, and again, the reason that I reached out to you, as with all of our Pioneers Path guests, is because we're interested in understanding about the visionary, how you think, how you operate, how you see the world, and your unique ability of being a visionary, the treacheries, the ups and downs. And you in particular have a really neat story, really around your career, what you do, and what your mission is. I cannot wait to share that with our audience.
Well, thank you. You're very kind.
So if you could, take us through a couple of things. One, I just want to hear about you. Tell us about you. Who are you?
Oh, well, it's pretty boring, actually. I'm not from Atlanta. I came here after law school, had a great career as a lawyer, then went to work for the governor of Georgia for 4 years as his executive assistant, then went out on my own to raise money and become a developer, first for student housing and then military housing, and now workforce affordable housing.
Mm. So housing sounds like the common theme there. Why? I mean, what drew you to housing?
I kind of stumbled into it, to be honest with you. I had pretty good instincts on the student housing side about the real estate business model for students up until then was, you know, you lived wherever you could find a place, a dormitory, a fraternity house, somebody's basement, somebody's spare bedroom. And since you didn't know any better at the time, that all worked. But beginning with my children, I began to see a transformation that, well, I guess you could call them spoiled. They didn't want to live in their grandfather's or father's dormitory. They didn't want to share a room that was too small for them, let alone for them and a roommate. They didn't want to walk down the halls and share a bathroom with 40 other people. So back in the early 90s, we decided to see if we couldn't design a real estate solution to that emerging problem. And we did. We were the pioneers in it. Nobody was doing it before we did. But what we designed was a one-bedroom, one-bathroom unit plan within a unit that had anywhere from 2 to 4 bedrooms and 2 to 4 bathrooms. It ended up, everybody gets his or her own bedroom and his or her own bathroom, so they don't have to share anything except a common space with a kitchen and a living room. And we were ahead of our time, but not so much that we got ahead of our customers. And we had the 90s to ourselves. We did it all over the Southeast, especially. And then moved nationwide. And since then, we've built and bought student housing on campus and off campus from California to Michigan, down to Florida, and across back over to California.
Wow. Clearly, where I went to school had not gotten that message yet. I really was in a shared housing situation, and it was very uncomfortable. So was it well received in the marketplace?
You know, it was. From the very beginning, we started leasing, and we leased by the bedroom, not by the unit. So everybody was responsible for his or her own lease, didn't have to worry about your roommate dropping out of school or getting kicked out of school or whatever. So if your roommate moved, that was between him or her and the landlord, you didn't have to pick up your share. So we leased by the bedroom. We started on January the 6th of 1991 to lease 480 beds at 2 projects, one at Florida State and one at Mississippi State. And by the end of that month, they were 100% pre-leased.
Wow.
For the next year. And they were under construction, so you really couldn't go tour one. You just kind of had to have a vision. We had some drawings on it, but the kids were so eager for something that they'd never had before.
Mm-hmm.
They signed right up, and we kept doing it all the flagship schools in the SEC, and then over to Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas State, Missouri, all over. And now it's a nationwide business, actually.
So it's true testament to how truly oblivious to the world I am. I was at Mississippi State at that time, and yeah. I had no idea that that was even an option.
Well, shame on us. That means bad marketing.
No, the receiver antenna was broken. Trust me.
I see. Okay. It was we've been very lucky, very fortunate. We've gotten a lot of equity from U.S. and foreign investors who saw the same thing we did. You know, mm-hmm. more and more people are going to college than ever before.
Mm-hmm.
More and more of them have to pay more and more of their fair share. Last year, for the first time in history, tuition was paid, and all those costs were more paid by the families than by mm-hmm. the state. So for the first time in our history, the state was funding less and less than the parents were. So affordability is becoming increasingly important, but the kids still want to have their own bedroom and their own bathroom.
Right. So you would say that this was a more cost-effective?
Oh, it certainly is more cost-effective and more rent-effective too. What happens, you get four tenants in what used to be a one or two tenant unit. And that means you get a retail price at a wholesale cost, which is pretty good economics.
Right. Interesting. What was your decision-making criteria for which school do we go to next?
Oh, we did some preliminary marketing. It was difficult because there was nothing to point to and say, hey, let's do one of those. It's kind of like one of my smarter friends said, well, it's kind of like quantum physics. You change the reality by participating. And that's what we did. But it was an informed bet, but that's what it was. It was informed, but it was incomplete in our information, but it was also a wager that we could do something at a price point that kids had never done before and turned out to be correct.
Cecil, I'm pretty sure that you just threw physics out there on this show.
I'm a history major, so don't ask me any more questions about physics.
So if you saw my eyes gloss over and you, I saw that you were just speaking Klingon, just saying, that's okay. So. No, I'm just kidding. That's So you just got to jump in and change the paradigm.
I mean, that's exactly what we did. And now everybody does that. I don't know of anybody who's building student housing the way it was 25 years ago. Even the on-campus housing today, nobody's building dormitories. They're building what we built off campus because the universities increasingly are using the quality of their housing to attract students.
Right, right. That's really interesting because you're right. The paradigm has changed for families who want to send their kids to school now, and even a kid coming into college, it's daunting because you go from this certain lifestyle, you know, living at home, if you're lucky, and then going off to college, and then all of a sudden the whole world was different back then. So you've actually made it a little bit easier of an on-ramp.
We think so. The kids want something that is tough to reconcile it when you first think about it. They want space, their own private space. They also want places to hang out.
Yeah.
And so we satisfied the space requirement by giving them their own bedroom and their own bathroom. But then, especially for freshmen and sophomores who want more roommates rather than fewer, when we had a four-bedroom, four-bathroom that was sharing the kitchen and the living room, they could come out of their bedroom and hang out with people who were already their friends or at least going to become their friends. And we also designed the area amenities so that they would attract kids to come hang out around the pool or in the clubhouse or whatever like that. Mm-hmm. But they could always retreat back into their private spaces, which is what they wanted.
Right. Really interesting. And now other people have followed that model. They've followed either the concept, the popularity, the financial aspect of it. So I always say that you can either leave a wake of dead bodies or a wake of prosperity behind you.
Well, to my knowledge, there's nobody in our wake that died.
That's the goal.
Right.
We have very low standards here in the Pioneer's Path, but no one croak, please. But but it is interesting. That's the mark of a true pioneer, a true visionary, right? They go out there and you can always tell a pioneer when they have arrows in their back.
Right. You can. They're also the first ones to find gold.
That's correct.
Right.
Right.
And you've also got to be careful because being first in the private sector means you are going to be called a pioneer. In some cultures, mostly bureaucratic, being first is not being called a pioneer. It's being called a guinea pig.
Hmm.
And people betray their worldview by the choice of words that they make. And you can go into institutions where being first terrifies people because they're more afraid of failing than they are being successful.
So what are you more attracted to?
Well, you know, I've been lucky all my life. I like doing new things. We've continued to do our student housing, but several years ago, both in my day job as a student housing developer, and also I was chairman of the Atlanta Housing Authority for about 15 years, we began to see that our construction costs were just skyrocketing. And they were going up at prices that didn't reflect traditional price increases, like the price of copper, the price of lumber, the price of oil. They were going up much, much higher than that. So I did some investigation and found that what was causing that price increase was an incredible labor shortage. What began happening in 2009 is that hundreds of thousands of men and women in the construction industry left the country to go home, and now they can't get back into the country. And hundreds of thousands of others left the construction industry and have jobs in more stable industries where today they've got a paycheck every 2 weeks, they've got health benefits, and they don't have to worry about where the next job is coming from after this apartment complex is finished. So you have a tremendous supply demand imbalance. And among other things, what that means is that the costs of labor and construction are now so high that you end up, and this is true in Atlanta, when you go along looking at the Peachtree spine of what's being developed, it's being developed for very wealthy people, the 1% who can afford to pay $3 a foot in rents or $1 million for a condominium. And it's kind of like Mercedes and BMW. They build great cars and they're expensive and they make great margins, but most of the market is in the Hyundai, Kia, Toyota, Ford. So what I decided, both the Housing Authority and my own business, that I was going to focus on coming up with an affordable solution, which meant that I had to come up with a new construction delivery system because the old ways obviously weren't going to work because the prices were too high. So I did what you normally do. You look around and say, well, what's anybody else doing? And I looked at shipping containers. They're cute. They'd be great for retail and maybe for temporary housing after disasters or after the Olympics. But I went up to New Haven to look at a 14-unit container apartment project. And I walked in and said, this is not going to work for 24/7 living. Mm-hmm. Panelization is not ready yet. Their costs haven't come down sufficiently, and they still have to do a lot of work on site in the weather and everything. And so finally, what I came upon was that modular manufacturing, which was really started and perfected in Europe after the Second World War, is what this country is going to have to do to build affordably anything, whether it's housing, single family, multifamily, retail or commercial, because the traditional construction methodology is, they're hung by the cost, and those costs are not temporary. You've got almost a permanent structural challenge to the construction industry today because the average age of construction worker in America is 45, which means the parents aren't telling their children to grow up to be masons or mechanical engineers or electricians or framers and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So that demand supply imbalance is going to continue. And so the solution for affordable construction is going to have to be modular. And I decided that that's what we were going to do going forward with our residential. And now we're doing two modular residential complexes in Atlanta, downtown at MARTA stations. And we just set our first single family modular home in Atlanta, over on the west side on James P. Brawley.
Wow.
It's the only way to deliver an attractive, affordable residence. And I really want to remind your listeners that modular is no longer a synonym for mobile homes or trailer parks. It's not. It really has, the major manufacturers of modular housing have really gotten their act together. And if I took you into a modular home or a modular apartment without telling you, as smart as you are, Tim, you couldn't figure out that it was modular, I promise you.
Well, I appreciate that. I look at colors. Is this blue or white?
Right? Construction. Either one you want. We can do that.
I got nothing after that. No. So modular manufacturing. So are you manufacturing?
No, right now we're buying the homes from other manufacturers. It's interesting you'd say that. But right after this interview, I'm going out to look at a couple of sites to start our own modular manufacturing facility.
Here in Atlanta.
Here in Atlanta, right.
So bringing jobs back into the manufacturing sector. So how many people, I don't know if this is a fair question or not, how many people or labor hours are you projecting to create the single unit?
Each shift will employ about 180 people, entry-level jobs. They can be trained to do, they can be trained, for example, to do the plumbing in the bathroom without being certified plumbers, because as the module moves down the assembly line, if my responsibility is to put in the commode or the basin or whatever, I don't need to know what the plumber's doing for the kitchen or the washer dryer. It's a matter of knowing what I do with the module that comes in front of me. So they're entry-level jobs. They can be trained for those in a couple of weeks and get paid $16-17 an hour. It's kind of like the idea that Henry Ford had when he doubled the daily wages from $2.50 to $5. Everybody was making fun of him and saying, you obviously didn't have to do that because they were working for $2.50. And he said, well, what's not obvious to you is that I make more money selling Model Ts or whatever I was making to a whole new universe of customers who, until I was paying them $5 a day, couldn't afford my cars. Hmm. I make more money on the finished product than it cost me by doubling their wages. And one of our goals is to create a middle class working on our facility, in our facility for our modules, where they can afford the houses that they're helping to build.
Wow. That is amazing.
Well, it may be, it's amazing, but it's certainly reassuring. And I think it's for your customers or for your listeners, sorry, it's very, very scalable, because there is one crisis in this country that's not overblown, and it is the affordable housing crisis. San Francisco and New York are the poster children for it, but it doesn't matter what city or town, actually in some rural areas, the affordable housing crisis is every bit as severe as it is in inner city urban areas. For example, there are a lot of major employers in rural areas. I know one in Georgia very well that would love to expand its plant production. It pays a very good wage. The work is safe, and there's a great demand for their product. The problem is they are in a northern part of a very rural county, and to expand, they would have to import people driving or riding 50 miles a day each way. And people do it until they find a job closer to home. And they do that because the problem is there's not affordable housing close to the facility. So all of a sudden, the dilemma for this plant manufacturer is not demand for his product, not the quality of his product, not the wages that he's paying, but a housing issue that isn't part of his business model. But if he doesn't solve it, he's not going to be able to solve his business problem either.
So is a natural expansion of this concept, like in that scenario, almost like a master plan community with modular homes being, you know, a part of that?
Tim, it could become that. I think in the early days, what you'll find modular homes being very effective for, certainly in urban areas, is infill. Because since it's a manufacturing process, we can economically build one, two, or three houses. There's no minimum critical mass that we have to have. There might be in a subdivision. This house that we just set 2 weeks ago was manufactured in 3 days and set on its foundation in an afternoon. So in less than 2 weeks, we had everything permitted, buttoned up, and ready for the open house, which we happened yesterday.
Wow. Wow.
So it's very scalable in the inner city, the hot areas of Atlanta, the hot areas of other cities. You just think of the verticals where it could go. The homeless populations, for example. You've got hospitals, large hospitals, especially in rural areas that have trouble attracting qualified people. You've got folks who do all the heavy lifting at resorts throughout the country. They can't afford to live in the ski areas or at Hilton Head, for example. You've got men and women who work full-time and part-time at the national and state parks. There's no place for them to live. And affordable construction is the only way that we're going to be able to provide safe, secure shelter at an affordable price for all of these workers. The service workers, for example, in the urban areas, perfect example that we know very well, 98% of the men and women who work in Buckhead can't afford to live there because there's no affordable housing for them. Wouldn't it be great if several of the major employers got together and said, you know, one of the benefits of working for me is we've got access to this affordable housing. And if you'll come work for us, you can live there at a price that you can afford. And all of a sudden, housing becomes not only an inducement to the employee, but kind of like a golden handcuffs to keep them there. Hmm. Because if they left their job at wherever they were working, right, they, when their lease expired, they'd be gone. So I think it's a great solution to avoid retraining issue. For example, that if you have 100% turnover, for example, in your employment force, and a lot of hotels do, mm-hmm, if you could cut that in half just by providing an affordable place for your workers to live, that money goes right to the bottom line. You don't have to retrain everybody.
Right. So if your pattern is consistent,
thanks,
there will be, not to put you in a box or a module, but in this case, if your pattern is consistent and if you're right, Cecil, there's going to be others who will be following you.
You're right about that, Tim. I think as Steve Jobs said about consistency, you can only connect the dots by looking backwards. And so I can connect the dots by looking back. I can't even see the dots tomorrow, let alone to connect them. Mm. But in terms of competition, look, it's not rocket science. It's harder than that.
It's only a man in space.
Yeah, because what we're doing is we're disrupting 10,000 years of history. Mm. You know, whether you were building the pyramids or the Great Wall of China or the cathedrals of Europe or this building that we're in, you built it the same way. You found the site, you brought the materials to the site, and then you brought the labor to the site to build the materials at the site that you wanted. It worked for 10,000 years until April of 1945 at the end of the Second World War. Hmm. Europe had to rebuild because it had bombed its real estate infrastructure into rubble. So they knew where they wanted to rebuild. They had the materials that they could recycle to build it there, but they just killed 12 million men and women. Hmm. The labor force wasn't there. And they could either wait 20 years and hope that the children growing up would want to be electricians, masons, or carpenters, or figure out a new way to do it. Hmm. And they started tinkering mostly in England and Holland and Germany and started, in effect, building shelter in a manufacturing facility that... it worked. It's not pretty to look at over there because it's so utilitarian. But here, we're able to get the architects and the contractors to understand that we'd like some aesthetic appeal, curb appeal. The issue here has not been driven by the necessity of war. Hmm. It has been accelerated by the labor shortage that I talked about before. But what you're really talking about, and this is the reason I kind of half-jokingly said it's harder than rocket science, is you're asking contractors, architects, engineers to change 10,000 years of doing things. Mm. And that's not easy.
Right.
Because you've got a contractor saying, well, wait a minute, you know, I used to prepare the site and the pads for parking and the pads for the apartments or for the house. And now all of a sudden, I've got to attach this module to this platform. Who's liable if it goes wrong? Mm. And all of a sudden, the general contractors, too, have a lot less to do on the site than they did before because a lot of that construction is done in the plant. Mm-hmm. Same problem with the architect. The law requires an architect to be the architect of record, which mm-hmm. means from the time it's just a blank sheet of paper until it's stamped and approved, the architect's responsible for that design and engineering. But in the case of a module, a lot of that's already done
right. Before
the architect even sees it. And you have to integrate the architect's professional skill, responsibility, and liability as the architect of record with the fact that it's manufactured in a plant and been designed previously in a plant. And that's taken about 2.5 years to overturn 10,000 years of history from these very accomplished professionals. And that's why it's harder than rocket science.
Right. Well, it's only 2.5 years. Well, you're making good time.
Well, they're good students. They understand. They're quick.
So, I mean, that's fascinating because you're right. You're changing the paradigm.
Right.
Right. You are entering the paradigm to change it. And so where do you see, what's the big problem here that you really think, if you could sum all of that up into the one big thing that is on your brain, that's on your mind, that you feel like you've been uniquely prepared to solve?
Well, What I see as a challenge isn't a modular as a new technology. It's not. It's unlike a lot of things like the iPhone that didn't have any precedent. No, there was nothing you could look at and say, oh yeah, we're just going to do better than iPhone. This technology has been proven in England. I've visited probably 52 plants here and over there. So it's not like it's new. What it has is a cultural prejudice against it. Because most people, when you say modular, automatically default to trailer homes, mobile homes, and cheap. And it isn't. So you've got to overcome, from a developer's perspective, you've got to overcome that market innocent ignorance and change the concept or change the thinking about what modular really is. And that's why it's so important for us to get these first homes and these first apartments built so people could come see and say, wait a minute, that's modular? Are you kidding me? And yesterday was our open house and we, I don't know, had 70 to 100 people there. Not a single person knew that it was modular and didn't guess. They didn't go up to it and say, oh my gosh, that's a modular house. If I took them to a trailer park, they would know that it was a trailer. But bringing them to this, absolutely no idea that it was modular. But still, you've got that education that you have to do to tell the customers that, look, just because it's manufactured offsite in a factory doesn't mean that it's of lower quality. If anything, it's probably of a better quality. The fit and finish is better. It's much more environmentally sensitive. There's no waste. There's no, you know, you don't have to measure twice and cut once. The laser's already done that for you. So there's no waste in the plant. You don't have any fires going on at the job site where the 2x4s came in and they didn't measure twice and cut once. There's no dumpster at a site because there's no waste at the site. As I said, the house that we set on Brawley was built and was manufactured in 3 days, and it was set in 3 hours.
Wow.
So that morning, there was nothing on the site except the foundation. That afternoon at 5 o'clock, you had a completed house already buttoned up and weathered.
Wow. Passers-by must have thought that they were in the wrong place in the morning than they were in the afternoon.
Actually, several, including a policeman who goes by there on his way to work. He got out of his car and said, wait a minute. You know, 2 days ago, there was nothing here and I took the day off and now I come back and there's a whole house. What in the world are you doing? It's that sort of aha moment that we like, actually.
I would have seized the moment to be a goofball and said, well, we're glad you're back. You've been in the hospital for
yeah,
at least...
it's a time warp. Yeah.
Yes. This is your future self. No, but well, Cecil, would you be willing to hang out in the studio for just a few minutes? We want to get to our next guest, but I want to bring both of you back and just ask you a little bit more about your personal journey.
Sure, no problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next up in the studio, we've got Mr. Rob Riggs from Your Design Online. Rob, how are you?
Great. Thanks for having me in.
Absolutely. On the Pioneer's Path, we, again, this is a show about visionaries and visionaries are designed to think differently. They're genetically encoded to stand out from the crowd. And there's a big reason for that. And we can't explain it sometimes. We just have to act on it and be who we are. And Rob, in our previous conversations that you and I have had leading up to this show, you strike me very much as a visionary. Who are you?
Sure. Well, I can't wait to see which of my neighbors you know. I'll start, I guess, early days. I was a computer programmer in my previous life. And so I did cool things, connecting e-commerce orders. So I was working with a clothing manufacturer and we were selling electronically to Walmart, Kmart, Target, Meijer, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And what I liked about that, it was just that it was kind of new in the industry where we were no longer ordering on paper. Mm-hmm. We were not getting orders on paper. We were, creating a technology per se that accepted orders and then passed them through our labor force to make those happen. And I enjoyed what I did for several years. At the end of the day, I was staring at pages and pages of code, and I left because I was looking to do something a little more creative. So I'm appreciative of the education that I got there. But this was 2004, I think. So the internet had been around, but I was looking for ways to kind of leverage that and help small business with web technology that they didn't have access to. Mm. Mm-hmm. And now, 15 years later, everybody's doing it. And it was, uh, You know, whether or not we thought it was a fad or whatever, the internet's here to stay. My take, so I started doing everything myself. So as a way to make a couple hundred extra dollars a month and express some creativity. As I grew in maturity and in business ownership, I quickly realized that that was not a way to survive long term. So I started hiring help. Initially, it was freelancers, and it was a great way to grow without a lot of overhead. But as time went on, I saw the benefit of having the same people involved in every project, building a team with some history together. And 2010, et cetera, we started hiring local people in the office every day. And I was amazed at how much that impacted the story we told and the way that we grew business. Hmm. So it was fantastic.
So the story that you told, in other words, the client's stories that you told, or
sure,
yeah, give our audience a little bit more context around what your teams did for your clients or do.
Sure. So we, you know, like we mentioned, everybody's got a website now. Mm-hmm. To me, that's not differentiating enough for somebody to tell their story. But we find tremendous benefit in leveraging technology to bring better ROI. So it's not just bringing clients to look at a website, but that website can produce sales. It can take orders. It can work some administrative tasks in the back end, to where it's really replacing the staff members for small businesses, and it's much more economical. It's a CISO. You find an area where there's a need and leverage what technology is available to accomplish more with less. Mm. So we look at automating what we can, integrating business systems, but really working on that back end to eliminate manual labor, data entry. It's a lot of times you get an order in from a website, you've got to key in data somewhere else into an order system. And it takes time. There's room for error when you're doing things manually. Integrating those systems, automating what you can, just eliminates a lot of that headache.
So traditionally, your industry, in my opinion, uses a lot of that contract labor or the freelancer, and they'll fill in the blanks here, fill in the blanks there. But you just mentioned something in that, and I love what you just said. We realized that we could build a team that told the story better together.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
To me, that's unique. And why was that so important, and why is it so important to you?
So if you were to look at my personality profile, I value very much relationships.
I took a personality profile one time. It came back negative. But I'm sorry. It's not about me. Go ahead.
That's great. I'm looking for, it's not just employees. I look at the people we spend the most of our time with. It's even more than the time we spend at home with our families. It's our families during the day at work, in the office. And so it's really important to me to have a culture, a fit that works well together. When you're hiring, you're looking for skills, sure, but are they culturally a fit? And I can't tell you how many times that we've hired for skill and it hasn't worked out, but you hire for culture and skills are trainable.
Right, right. What I've noticed in what I do as a business coach is culture is really the convergence between your core values, mm-hmm. and your what you identify as your core purpose. I mean, the mixture of those two things really defines who you are and what you do.
Sure.
And so it's interesting and refreshing to find leaders who are hiring around those two criteria further over skill, because there are people that will smart you out of business.
Sure.
Right. And I've seen that in the past. I'm sure you guys have as well. So do you have your core values clearly defined, and what are they?
So we do. And it's, I know the idea is to get it down to simple things that the entire team can recite. And I've got an entire page. I'd love to pull that up. For sake of time, the short, mm-hmm. short version, we leverage technology mm-hmm. to help people accomplish more. And so whether that's, you know, our clients, whether that's our team members, we really look to bring technology in a way that it hasn't been used before to accomplish mm-hmm. things that people couldn't do on their own.
Mm-hmm. And they're passionate about that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that's really kind of where you you saw an opportunity, and buried in lines of code,
right?
You saw an opportunity to automate that, and again to tell a story, you know, which and sometimes an automated way, and sometimes you know, a way that's always helpful. Let's put it that way, you know, to a client, and found a way to monetize that.
Sure.
So how many employees do you have now?
So we have 16. Mm-hmm. And so we're comfortable. We're looking at you know, a couple new hires, but in the areas of project management, mm-hmm. and then always looking for good web developers. Mm-hmm. So if there's anybody out there listening, I think we fit a hole. There's a gap. What I've seen over the years between what small business need and what they can afford. Mm-hmm. So similar again to Sam, mm-hmm. and I think. The stories Cecil told earlier is so common, from, you know, the college dorm room where I, you know, could stand in the center of a room and touch both walls. Mm-hmm. But when they fit, you know, three other guys in there, finding a need in the industry and working to solve that uniquely. But for us, our clients were, looking with it, they had a need, right? We've worked with some of the large companies that are out there, but my passion is for small business, making cool things happen that I don't have an 18-month sales cycle to get into a 5-year project, and we'll still take that work, but I really like to take the experience we've had with big brands and take that down market. Because there's a lot that we can leverage again for that smaller business and help a smaller local community. Mm-hmm. But in our industry, there's either big agency where everything becomes a big project and they don't want to talk to a business that's less than 200K in annual revenue, or there's the guy working in his mom's basement or in the garage. And you know, not to slight that, because I started there. So I've been there, but there's a need, that gap that they can't fill, mm-hmm. that the large agencies aren't interested in filling. And I think that's where we step in and provide a good value based on, again, big brand experience, and bring that down market to where people can actually afford that.
Right. So you and your team, sounds like you are filling that gap. Because the big agency, I mean, if the client doesn't understand what an agency of record is, then, you know, that's kind of like criteria one. If you don't know what that even means, go away.
Sure.
But, you know, I when I started my business, one of my businesses, it was, I can't afford that agency, but there's got to be a way to leverage the evolving, you know, internet technology with automation. But I don't know how to get there.
Right.
You know, aren't there any tools that the big boys play with that we can play with?
Absolutely.
So that sounds like what you're able to bring to the market.
So, right. We can help implement tools that are already out there, because mm-hmm. why reinvent the wheel? Why build it if it already exists? Mm-hmm. But a lot of times there are 3 tools, 7 tools, whatever, that a company needs to leverage that are in different places, mm-hmm. right? There's an inventory system that's in the back office. There's mm-hmm. CRM that helps them acquire new business. Other platforms which help them spread their message, but they don't talk to each other. And that's also where we can come in and help piece things together, so they log into one interface and access all of the data that they need.
Mm-hmm. So how do you find new customers?
So it's we've got a sales team of 2.5, and and probably I'm the half. if you will, because I'm focused on growing the business, but also, you know, payroll and you know, somebody needs a new mouse or whatever. But personal relationships, referrals, probably 85%, I believe, is our new business coming in the door is referrals. Mm-hmm. And so that's very important to us, which tells a good story. You know, we're doing good work for people when they're going to refer us. But personal relationships, we are not the the cheapest in the market, because there's value that we bring that the cheapest in the market just doesn't have access to, or mm-hmm. the knowledge or experience, whatever. But so when that personal relationship exists, honestly, we can have those conversations about budget and what somebody's trying to accomplish, the objectives of a project, and advise on a consultative basis to see what's really going to have the biggest impact on what they're looking to accomplish. So is it revenue? Is that the biggest need right now? Mm. Or are they struggling with, I'm experiencing a lot of data issues where, we're having inconsistency across platforms. Is it, an issue where my employees need a portal to log into to access, we built an HR portal for a company with 50,000 employees that they just couldn't handle it all. So they have 30 different vendors providing services. So, from payroll to, benefits, medical insurance, time tracking, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Rather than log into 30 different places, their team, their employees now can log into one interface and accomplish what they're looking to accomplish.
Almost like an application layer. Single
absolutely.
Layer. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, I just made that up.
So.
So that's really interesting because you're leveraging a really small team by comparison's sake of 16 and three quarters people
sure.
to solve some really big challenges, which cost big companies and even mid-sized companies a lot of money.
Right.
What is your favorite project to work on?
My favorite is the small mom and pop. They are looking to do something unique in the marketplace. Nobody else has done it. They've got this great idea, or they've seen somebody else do it, but they want to take a different spin. Mm. Again, they've got the decision-making power mm-hmm. To make things happen. Budget is not always there, but again, if we can provide a solution that's closer to their budget than what a big brand would spend, then that's a win in my book.
Mm. And so that's your favorite. What is, I'll ask you this, what's your least favorite kind of project? What's your favorite one to say no to? How about that?
Sure. Good question. So I don't typically take on projects where somebody doesn't have an idea what they're looking to accomplish. We can have conversations about, helping somebody decide what's really going to make a difference in a business. But if they just don't know, then we can't help them decide how their business is going to benefit.
Right.
We can show a lot of, have you thought about this? Mm-hmm. We could do this based on somebody's need, but we need somebody who knows where they're going, what they need, and we can help make it accomplish.
Right. Good. Well, that's where you've been. That's where your path and your business path coming up here. What I'd like to do with both Cecil and Rob now is really kind of bring you guys together and just ask you the same question. Because I'm fascinated whenever we get a room full of visionaries together in the same room, I swear I think the earth is going to crash into the sun whenever that they get too close.
Right.
But the answers to these are sometimes consistent, sometimes very, very different. Let me ask both of you, what would you say and your path has been your biggest mistake that you've made up to this point on a professional level?
For me, recognizing the difference between a leader and a manager. As one of my former law partners told me one day that a leader is the person who does the right thing. A manager is the person who does things right. And he was very careful to point out that there is no hierarchy between those two. Hmm. You need both of them. And he was very dubious, and I happen to agree with his doubt, that one person can be good at both. Hmm. And sometimes I lost sight of that lesson. I wanted to be both the leader and the manager. And one of the beauties of middle age is that you can be honest with yourself without diminishing yourself. And so in my business, especially as we're growing now on the modular side, I'm going to focus on being the leader and giving equal dignity to whomever I hire to be the manager, because without somebody to do things right, doing the right thing is futile.
Rob? So I know we have to let that settle.
Right.
Right. That was like a basket full of fortune cookies that just did it at the same time.
It's tough to follow these.
Yeah. Sorry. We should have let it.
Sorry, Rob.
Sorry.
No, mine would relate to people too. I think my fortune cookie answer is, goes back to hire slow, fire fast. It's, again, when you're looking for a culture, it's not always easy to see who is a fit, but it's really easy to see when they're not.
Right.
And oftentimes you get into trouble holding on to somebody that you have the best intentions for, but if they're not going to get it, then part ways amicably and quickly.
And quickly
yeah.
is the big one. Right. Right. So it's interesting. Every visionary that I've had the privilege of talking to both before and in this show, you guys have all had the same common thing around mistakes. It's been people, managing people. And so I'm waiting for somebody to say, yeah, well, it was blah, 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 something else. I haven't heard that yet. So there may be more scientific studies coming later, but certainly not here.
Right.
Let me ask you guys another question. So where do you see yourself? What's happening in 5 years? We fast forward our super duper time frame machine, boom. Where are you and what are you working on and what problems are you solving?
Sure. Obviously things are changing quickly, especially in the area of technology. Mm-hmm. Looking ahead, who knows where things are going? I couldn't have predicted that social media was going to be as big as it is and have a big impact on business. That is something we're looking into. How can we leverage in a bigger way? What platforms can we offer? And mostly things are moving in the area, software as a service, things are becoming more and more modular. To where I can plug and play, access my data that's on a platform, access it wherever I need it. And that's something we've been working on for the past year or so, 2 years now, in taking data and making it available in a dashboard or other systems to where I can accomplish what I need in a platform that is already built and robust. I don't want to have to log into, again, 30 different systems to accomplish what I need. Mm-hmm. If I can access my data, push data, whatever, from one interface, then it's a lot more useful to me as a business owner.
Right. So single sign-on, but also single point of access.
Absolutely.
Streamlining the entire data exchange.
Sure. So just a quick example. I've got one dashboard that we built that helps us forecast sales. It pulls information from our CRM. Mm-hmm. It reaches into our project management system to show us how many projects we have, how estimated hours versus actually worked hours, how profitable projects are, when we're estimated to actually launch and get them off the books. Pull in QuickBooks so we can see where we are compared to last year, where we're forecasting to be next year.
Wow.
So one dashboard, again, pulling data from the disparate systems.
I agree with you. I think that's where it's less is more.
Sure.
Right. Which is contrary to the sheer mass of data and that is exponentially growing. We don't want more. We need less in order to be effective.
Right.
So it's information versus data. So I find it fascinating that you can make one. You can almost do a sensitivity analysis around if I miss this deliverable date, it has the cascading effect across these parts of my business.
Right.
So I'm a genius.
So, nicely done.
No, thank you. Thank you, Brian. No, no, that's fantastic. So less is more sounds like, or simplified is where you see things in 5 years.
Absolutely, because the, you know, again, we're technology brings more and more at our to our fingertips, and but it's not giving us more hours in the day. So if we can streamline what we're having access to, the effort involved in accessing or managing, then that's so much better use of our time. So we can get down to it. So we can make decisions. So we can get down to the, you know, actually what we're supposed to be doing all day.
That's such a visionary answer. All right. Cecil, fast forward 5 years.
Well, Tim, you're asking me to do the impossible, which is play Nostradamus. And you may be the genius, but I'm not that smart. I think that given the foundation, both on the student housing side, with more and more kids going to school because they have to get a good job and keep a job, and the affordability crisis that has been caused in large measure by the labor shortages that are not easily fixed, I think the foundations of our business are very, very good. But the solutions that I'm coming up with, I think I need to revisit them about every year, and I do. I suppose until we can 3D print buildings at a commercially scalable way, modules pretty safe, but never underestimate the speed with which technology can overtake you. As Satchel Paige once said, you know, don't look over your shoulder because they're gaining on you. And I've seen the prototypes of 3D printed buildings. They have a long way to go. And until really we can get concrete and cement as a viable, credible, competitive construction material for houses, I'm not going to worry too much about it. In fact, I'm not going to worry at all, because worry is, so somebody once said, is just interest on a loan that may never come due. So why pay it? I think I've done my homework. I think modular construction is certainly for the next 5 to 10 years going to be the most affordable solution for construction, not only in the residential side, but my goodness, you know, Marriott signed a contract last year for 50 of their AC branded hotels. They're all modular. Last year, Burger King signed a contract for 500 Burger Kings, all modular. And, you know, if those big guys are buying into it for the commercial side, I think I'm on pretty good ground about using modular for the residential side. The risk to the business aren't technology overcoming or passing us. It is what I said before. It's making sure that we execute properly and that we can show the market that their prejudgments about modular are out of date.
Interesting how we have, on one hand, technology to be leveraged to get more simple, and then on the other side, fighting that perception that certain technology isn't up to speed. So it's we're going a direct dichotomy between the two perspectives around technology. Very interesting. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Thank you, Tim.
Katie, thank you so much for producing and The Pioneer Path. This has been episode 2. I'm your host, Tim O'Connor.
And Tim, I mean, thanks so much. This wouldn't be possible without the great work of the Terraform Group and everything that you're doing over there. So what's going on with the Terraform Group? Anything new coming up?
We're continuing to work with the small to mid-sized business owner and helping them get vision, traction, and healthy with their leadership team.
Nice. And if someone wanted to learn more, where would they do that?
For the Terraform Group, it's www.terraformgroup.com.
Great. And Cecil, if someone wants to learn more about what you're doing, where would they do that?
They would go to cphillips@placeproperties.com.
Good work. And Rob, how about you?
Yourdesignonline.com.
Well, great. Thank you guys so much. This has been episode 2 of The Pioneer's Path. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.